I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Save big money on everything now at Menards. Make quick work of your outdoor cleaning project with Masterforce outdoor and landscaping tools. The 80-volt cordless trimmer is powerful, efficient, and hassle-free, so you spend less time working on your yard and more time enjoying the results. On sale now through May 19th. Check out our wide selection of Masterforce tools and see the rest of our deals on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Ich warte seit Wochen auf diesen Tag und tanz vor Freude über den Asphalt, als wär's ein Rhythmus, als gäb's ein Lied, das mich immer weiter durch die Straßen zieht. Komm dir entgegen.
Hallo und willkommen zu Gegenpressing, the Bundesliga Podcast. This is the main show. I'm Manu Feit. He's Stefan Bayankowski, and also he is Matt Ford. Hey guys, how's it going? First of all, Stefan, you returning from what looked like a gorgeous, gorgeous hike in Scotland. Beautiful day, apparently. How's it going?
Yeah, it was a beautiful day. It's the first kind of dry day we've had in 3 or 4 days. So the wife and I took the dog up. It's a valley near us called Glenfinglas. It's a nice little walk. It's only about an hour, 6 or 7 K, but I have Mondays off, so they're kind of like my Sundays. So yeah, it was a nice Sunday afternoon walk, shall we say. So I'm feeling refreshed.
Fantastic. And Matt, no soccer for you or football for you this evening. It got cancelled. Gives us a bit more time to record the show. That's great. But how are you doing otherwise?
Yeah, actually quite glad that my football got cancelled tonight. There's quite a few of us on our team have actually fallen a bit ill and picked up a bit of a cold. I don't think me running around in the rain in Frankfurt for half of yesterday afternoon has helped. But it's that time of the year, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Everyone is coughing and sneezing and the nose is running. The change of season is definitely here. Speaking of Frankfurt, I'm actually going to be in Frankfurt, not tomorrow, I'm flying tomorrow, but, you know, with the time change, time difference and all that, I will be there on Wednesday early in the morning, which is going to be, that's going to be terrible. I land at 8 o'clock in the morning, which means I have to stay up that entire day to do my jet lag therapy. And I'm only there for 5 days, so that's going to be crazy. But guys, we want to talk about the Frankfurt game and a bunch of other topics. So, you know, rather than playing around with formalities, let's get paid first and then jump right into the topics. This episode of the Gegenpressing Podcast is brought to you by BetOnline. The last major pro sports leagues kicks off this week, and BetOnline is your top spot for all your NBA action this season. With MLB postseason, NFL and college football, and NHL in full swing, BetOnline is your number one source for wagering news, odds, trends, and predictions. Get everything NBA at your fingertips with both desktop and mobile access for every sport, anytime. Head to BetOnline today to get in on the action. Don't forget to use the promo code BELIEVE, that is BLEAV, BELIEVE, to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, where the game starts. So yeah, boys, Frankfurt, I think, you know, we debated this before we started the podcast, and we right away started shouting at each other about VR and the uselessness of it all. And Matt, you were at this game, and the Marius Wolf, it was Wolf with the handball, right?
Yeah, the
penalty. We chatted about this on the WhatsApp chat. The referee team has now come out and admitted that this was a mistake. First of all, I am not one of the guys that says we need to cancel VAR, get rid of it, bin it, whatever. I think that's gone. That's not going to happen. Someone actually made an excellent point to me with all the betting now in sport. We're never going to get rid of it. But remember why we got VAR. We got VAR to get rid of clear and obvious errors. Guys, the referee looked straight at that handball. There was no need to go to a monitor or to like ask for backup or anything. You could just make the decision right there and then. And if you get it wrong, great. Well, not great, but you know, you get it wrong or you get it right. Either way, I don't think anyone would have complained about it, but they needed five extra minutes and got it wrong anyways. So I guess before we talk even about this game, I think this is something that we really need to debate here. I think the one thing I would really like to change about VAR is that we have to get referees back to refereeing. And now the floor is yours, guys. Matt, I know you have lots of thoughts about this too, so you can start with it.
I don't have any new thoughts, though. I remember having this discussion a few weeks ago, probably a few weeks before that, and indeed 3 or 4 years before that. So no particularly new thoughts.
Has it been that long already?
Maybe not 3 or 4, it's been 3, yeah, or 4.
No, 28, yeah, you're right, it's been 5 years.
Bloody hell, yeah, COVID breaks do things to your sense of time, don't they? It really has been that long. No, I really don't have much more to contribute on the fundamentals of it. I think people know my stance. I would get rid of it tomorrow, and as far as I'm concerned, the refereeing team and the DFB coming out today, so it's Monday evening, and admitting that it wasn't just the one decision with the Marius Wolf handball. It was also the penalty which wasn't given when Alex Meyer, the replacement goalkeeper, came out and basically took out Omar Mamouche before the ball. For me, a clear pen, and that one wasn't given. And the other way around, I thought that the penalty given against Marius Wolf for handball was really, really harsh, and yet that one was given. Turns out in hindsight, at least according to the DFB, that I was right. But so what? It still cost us about, well, in total 8 minutes. There were 8 minutes added time at the end of the first half in Frankfurt, and the decisions weren't even correct. So, yeah, I don't really have much more to add on that. It's a shame, I think, to start talking about it, because it was one of the most entertaining games I've been to in a long time. Really exciting game, really entertaining game, and it's a shame that we have to start by talking about VAR again, to be honest.
Stefan, do you think they made a make-up call there for the second penalty, knowing that they got the first one wrong?
Well, no, because as the old saying goes, two wrongs don't make a right. And
yeah, that's true.
This, I honestly think I completely agree with Matt. I would get rid of VAR tomorrow if I could. And I think this game's a perfect example of why it doesn't work, because you had two instances where the referee in real time chose not to make a decision. The VAR team in Cologne, or in the bunker in Cologne, or wherever they are now, I think they're still in Cologne, they decided that it was worth looking back, and they still made the wrong call. So at every line in the process, something went wrong. And it's a perfect example of why VAR doesn't work. And I've been making this point for a while now that, you know, we were promised, or the way that FIFA and UEFA sold VAR was that it was going to get rid of bad referee calls. But what that really meant was we're going to get rid of the human error in football, which was obviously never going to be the case, because the entire process still comes back to a human making a decision at some point in the decision line. And as we saw in this game, the two people, or the people making the decisions for the first penalty, which was given, which was a wrong call in my opinion, and the second penalty, which wasn't given, which was also a wrong call in my opinion. And it just goes to show that you can have cameras, you can have a second or third opinion, and you can go back and retrospectively look at these calls, and these referees will still get them wrong from time to time. So it's a complete fool's errand to try and eliminate human error from football. And that's my fundamental issue with VAR. It's trying to right a wrong that I think is a fundamental pillar of football. I think that's what makes it a beautiful game. I think you have to have a degree of luck or chance or an unquantifiable factor involved in football, so that, you know, it can't be just commoditized and wrapped up and sealed off and then sold, because that's what FIFA wants. You know, I don't want to turn to big rant about FIFA and UEFA here, but they're trying to minimize the little gaps and the little crookedness and the little imperfections in football, because as soon as they do that, they can sell it as a better product. So
yeah, I think that idea of removing jeopardy is also the same one that's behind, you know, the various attempts at, you know, Champions League reforms or Super League. I think both of those ideas, I think they come from the same sort of ideological background as VAR. They're trying to remove chance, trying to remove the unquantifiables, because ultimately, I suppose with that much money slashing around in the game, the unquantifiables are what risk losing teams massive amounts of cash. So I suppose from that purely,
that's what happens when you bring in billionaire owners mad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So football's built this. Yeah, has made this bed for itself, I suppose.
So we can blame Sky and the Premier League. That's great. I take that.
Yeah, well. And most of all, Manchester United.
I would subscribe to that. Absolutely. Take it from me.
No, but Matt, you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't want to derail this into a conversation about FIFA and UEFA, but I was honestly sitting kind of thinking about all this afternoon, thinking I feel like it if you just completely ripped football apart and tore it apart from these kind of centralized kind of magnetic pools that are obviously are these kind of figures that are trying to, you know, iron out all the wrinkles in football. If you just kind of got rid of all these things, arguably, in my opinion, even to the extent of disbanding the governing bodies entirely, in my opinion, yeah. I mean, do we really need a FIFA? Do we even really need a UEFA?
We need it, but not in the form it exists today.
This is getting quite revolutionary now, Stefan.
No, but like FIFA used to be a small office that oversaw the World Cup. That's
exactly
it.
Exactly. And like, if we actually went back to a situation where football is just run by the federations, and, you know, every time there's a World Cup, you know, 10 or 12 people get in a room and just kind of agree how it works, or they meet every 20 years and agree that the rules that they have in place work and keep going. I think football, going back to its roots in that sense, and eliminating the technology, eliminating the middlemen, eliminating the power, because with power comes money, and it's the money that is kind of, you know, it's the money that's trying to exert its control on the sport. And that's why we have things like VAR and all sorts of other things, as well as Matt said, you know, Champions League reform and all these bloody competitions that are forcing these players to play like 60 or 70 games a year, as if they're cattle going through a cattle farm or something, you know, and they have to be kind of commoditized. It's all just, I don't know. This is what happens when I go on a hike. I start thinking about stupid stuff.
I'm going to make a counter argument here a little bit. that is actually.
Can we just acknowledge that we start talking about Dortmund here, and I'm not saying we have to disband FIFA?
Yes, I mean we get the Dortmund.
This is what Dortmund does to people.
The big American sports that are also owned by big money, and in some ways American football is the richest league in the world, right? NFL, I mean, not American football, but NFL is the richest league in the world and it makes the most money. They ensure that someone else wins it pretty much every year. And, you know, although they have a similar thing to VAR, you know, chance can still happen there as well. Same thing with baseball, completely reinvented this year so that, you know, to increase the level of chance. It actually kind of speaks to what you're saying, Stefan, that like we almost need this level of chance. We need this level of surprise for sport to be truly successful. The one thing that I might want to add to the whole VAR debate, we have to remember VAR was brought in to eliminate clear and obvious errors. I'm talking about someone, you know, a referee missing a clear handball because a ball goes towards the line and someone, you know, plays goalkeeper and swipes the ball off and the referee misses that. That's a black and white situation, right? That's why we brought in VAR. We brought in the goal line technology, which I think is great as well. You know, that's a black and white situation. We didn't bring it in to measure whether a player was a millimeter offside or whether a handball was a handball or not. Those are not the things we brought in VAR in for. That's maybe my final point on that. And like, either you make it a black and white thing or you just don't. But essentially with this handball, let's bring it back to this Dortmund game, right? To this very situation. That handball is a subjective call, whether one referee looks at it or however many people sit in the bunker, like let's make it 6 or 7, right? It's still a subjective call. And we couldn't even agree in the WhatsApp chat. Like ultimately, I thought it was a handball. That's wrong, apparently. That's fine. I can live with that. But, you know, even we in the chat couldn't agree whether that was a handball or not. So that's a subjective call. So we have to give the refereeing back to the referees on the field.
Yeah.
I think you made a really good point in the chat, which I don't think you mentioned on the show, which I was waiting for you to say, was that, and I am just literally taking your point here, Manu, but I think you made a really simple point when you said it's almost like VAR is taking the responsibility out of the hands of the referees. And the way that the referees behaved in that Dortmund game was I can't remember the referee's name, but he was almost too scared or had gone into the habit of not making calls and just waiting for VAR to say, go back and make that call.
And that happens all the time, right?
Yeah.
It happens all the time. And that is the number one thing that bothers me about VAR, is that they're almost too scared to make the call live on the field.
Yeah, and it completely defeats the hope. This is my main issue, that you know we're trying to quantify something that shouldn't really be put in a box. We're talking about, you know, whenever we get into these discussions, I always feel like we have to remind ourselves we're talking about 22 men running around the pitch kicking a leather ball, and there's one guy there who's trying to watch it in real time and he's trying to make decisions in real time based on how and where he's viewing the pitch from, and that's all football is. Like, it's not politics, it's not business, it's not banking, it's not it's not therapy, it's just entertainment. And if we hadn't had VAR, maybe the referee would have made that call for the handball. Maybe he wouldn't. And maybe he would have made the call for the second penalty call, or he wouldn't. But I think the difference between back then and now is that it would have been made in real time. The players would have got on with it and we would have kept playing. And as Matt mentioned at the start of the show, we wouldn't have had to wait 8 minutes or have 8 minutes of additional time because there's so much faffing and going back and forth from the referee having to go view the screen and whatever else.
And we wouldn't have to spend 10 minutes talking about a game that had 6 goals on VAR, because that's how much we debated it. But that's true. I mean, like, we're talking about a game that had 6 goals and the main talking point is VAR. And that is kind of sad because, I mean, the Bundesliga had 42 goals this weekend, and you open any sports page and it's all about refereeing decisions, right? And you make this point with entertainment. I think we need to kind of try to get to a point again where the entertainment aspect is actually at the forefront rather than us having to debate the fundamentals of who's refereeing a game, whether it's a bunch of guys sitting in their refereeing uniform in a bunker in Köln or the three guys on the pitch.
Yeah. And let's be clear here, this isn't just a specific problem with Germany. Like on Threads this weekend I was talking about having to get rid of VAR, and I was mouthing off about it, and I had all these football fans in England saying, no, the problem is that the referees in England are all corrupt. And, you know, and I was trying to explain, look, we have this issue in every single league. And one commenter said, we should get the guys who did the World Cup because they did a really good job. To which I then said, the referees at the World Cup were the referees from all these domestic leagues, which, and they're also the referees that get criticised every single week by the football fans in their own countries. And this is the, I think this is the other big issue. I think maybe everyone's so siloed in their own league that they don't realise that, I don't know how or when we got to this point where everyone assumed the referee should be infallible, but we are now there, and it's obviously absolutely bonkers.
Okay. Can I make one final point before we give this to Matt on the six goals that actually happened at the game? MLS does a pretty good job of it. They only go if it's a clear and obvious error. That's my final point.
We're talking about serious leagues here.
Okay, let's talk about the six goals that actually happened. Matt, you were there. What was it like, other than referees?
Yeah, well, without all the VAR chat aside, and it really is a shame that we've had to spend 12, 15 minutes or whatever talking about that, because, it, like I said at the top, it really was one of the most entertaining games I've seen all season. And I think mainly responsible for that, Eintracht Frankfurt team, who under Dino Topmüller slowly but very surely coming into some sort of form. That's now three very impressive results on the bounce. Good away win against Hoffenheim last week, followed by the Conference League hammering of Helsinki. Okay, maybe not the toughest opposition with respect, but you have to. I think, as we said on Sunday, Manu, those six goals don't score themselves, so fair enough. And I thought, even though the game on Sunday didn't result in 3 points for them, probably their best performance of the three, though. Really, really impressive. I thought they probably did deserve more in the end, but the fact they didn't is probably down to the fact that they are still a work in progress. And I was, honestly, I was absolutely fascinated and incredibly impressed by the front four, which Frankfurt have seemed to have magicked out of their sleeves this season. I think everyone remembers a few years ago the famous Eintracht Frankfurt Buffalo Herd, you know, the Buffenherder of Ante Rebic, Luka Jovic, and who am I forgetting?
Sebastian Haller,
of course. I mean, yeah, they seem to have found a replacement for that attack. Not quite the same, perhaps, penetrative pace and physicality of those three, much more tricky characters. But and with a really, really strong North African connection, Omar Mamouche up front has been, I think, leading the line really effectively. Doesn't necessarily come across as your typical sort of number nine or central striker, but he's been playing that role really well. Backed up ably by the three behind him in Fares, Shaib, Ansgar Knauf, and who am I forgetting in the middle? Yes, exactly. Aurelio Buta on the right. And yeah, the combination plays fantastic, particularly in between Mamouche and Shaib. They proved that with some of the combinations away at Hoffenheim last week, and they were at it again against Dortmund. Must be said, however, and we'll get on to Dortmund in a sec, but they were helped by a series of really gaping holes on Dortmund's left flank, and we'll get to that in a bit. And I thought it wasn't just me that thought it, a lot of the Dortmund delegation also were quite aware that Remy Benzbaini and Gio Reyna had been a bit of a weak point down that left-hand side. But yeah, as I've written in the bulletin this week, that North African connection was finished off by the addition of Elias Skiri in midfield as well, and yeah, summed up by the third goal. Really, really clinical ball from Skiri into Shaib, and he's controlled it with maybe a little bit of luck, but he's also held off Ben Zbaini at the same time and finished really, really well. So really impressed with the performance from Eintracht Frankfurt. What I thought was interesting, and what I was actually talking to a few of the more regular Frankfurt reporters at half time, in some of my research around Frankfurt, I'd heard Topmuller sort of repeating this mantra that he doesn't want sort of gung-ho attacking football. He wants stability and he wants structure. I thought, okay, that's interesting, because from what I've seen recently of Eintracht Frankfurt, they absolutely are capable of playing really exciting, gung-ho, attacking football with that front four. And I put that to him in the press conference, and he said, yeah, that is true. Maybe we are we are able to do that, but the key is to do it from a more stable structure to avoid getting caught on the break. And even though this conceded three goals against Dortmund, he did point out that those three goals didn't come from them being caught out on the break. He actually gave the credit to Dortmund and said that Dortmund scored those three goals out of periods of their own possession. So I think that says a lot about what Dino Topmuller and Frankfurt are trying to do. He's well aware of the quality that he has up front in that front four. A front four which is keeping Mario Götze out of the starting 11 in the last month, by the way. He's not losing sight of the fact that the best teams and even the best offenses are built on a solid structure behind. So, really exciting times for Eintracht Frankfurt. I was very impressed.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode of the Gegenpressing Podcast is brought to you by BetOnline. The last major pro sports leagues kicks off this week, and BetOnline is your top spot for all your NBA action this season. With MLB postseason, NFL and college football, and NHL in full swing, BetOnline is your number one source for wagering news, odds, trends, and predictions. Get everything NBA at your fingertips with both desktop and mobile access for every sport, anytime. Head to BetOnline today to get in on the action. Don't forget to use the promo code BELIEVE, that is BLEAV, BELIEVE, to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, where the game starts. Niko Kovac was like that at Frankfurt too, right? He built everything from the back forward. Like we talk about that Büffelherde, but we have to remember that the foundation of that was the time under Kovac, right?
So I think that is actually kind of interesting as well.
I think it's interesting too that they've managed to keep that transfer that scouting system and transfer policy going. I don't think it would have been unreasonable at the time after they lost, Haller, Vebic, Jovic in quick succession, to think, okay, they might struggle now. There are also a few movements in the boardroom, particularly the departure of Freddy Bobic and Kovac as well. However, they seem to have restructured well, and that scouting system seems to be running as smoothly as ever. And all credit to Markus Krusher, the sporting director, and for putting together such a good squad. And also Dino Topmüller, he seems to have found a coach who is making a really, really good first impression.
Krusher is a good one. He's really highly regarded within the industry, and is considered a sporting director that has a lot of good contacts. He was obviously at Leipzig as well, so that helps a lot of networking, right?
I thought it was very telling at Leipzig that he actually didn't last that long, and I thought it was incorrect at the time that it was almost suggested between the lines in some reporting that that was a step too far for Markus Krusher. I think in hindsight, it's clear that the problem there was not Markus Krusher, but rather Oliver Minzlaff and some of the other movers in the Red Bull universe. Markus Krusher is very much proving that he's a very capable operator.
I mean, he showed it at Paderborn too, right? He found really good players there as well. Smaller budget, obviously, but still. Stefan, have we underestimated Frankfurt a little bit? Because, our mantra for a really long time has been, well, they're not going to be good until the winter when they are finally going to buy a striker. And here they are doing just great without a striker. Have we underestimated them a bit?
Yeah, we probably have. I think everyone did. I think maybe even Frankfurt did to an extent, in the sense that they kind of plucked Topmüller out of almost thin air, and he arrived at the club with very little first team experience, but senior head coaching experience. But I've been very impressed with him. I actually, we've talked on the show about the kind of counterculture to gegenpressing in the Bundesliga, and whether there is a kind of underswell of managers now realizing, well, hey, look, if we try things a little differently, we can actually catch a lot of these teams out when they do fly forward. And Frankfurt have done a great job of that this season. Maybe ironically or paradoxically, I thought this was a really weird game for both Frankfurt and Dortmund, because, I think both of them have had a lot of success with very kind of, very strong defensive performances, very kind of regimented build-ups, and they both seem to be far more comfortable breaking teams down on their level or at their speed. But this was actually a game in which both teams really kind of threw everything at it, and it was like a basketball game at times, and it was just back and forth, which certainly wasn't the way that Dortmund have been playing this season. And maybe that was a case where they were just reacting to Frankfurt's really impressive start. And, much of that was due to the fact that Frankfurt clearly targeted Benzemaini on the left flank. As Matt succinctly put in the bulletin, Gio Reyna wasn't offering any kind of help on that left side. That's a really fascinating little subplot as well in itself, that he started. First start, I think, since February in the league for Dortmund. Did very little. Put one cross in for Daniel Malm, which he could have maybe scored, and then gets pulled off at halftime before he's even really found his feet in the game. But maybe that's something that, in a quieter game, maybe that's something we could have made more of. But anyway, I don't know. And then in contrast to that, Dortmund seemed to really struggle when Frankfurt forced them to play this kind of counter-attacking football, which they haven't really been doing under Terzic. And as Matt mentioned, Topmüller makes a really good point that if you actually do watch all the Dortmund goals, particularly I think the Moukoko goal, they come about from Dortmund actually putting their foot on the ball, taking a moment to breathe, and then trying to pass the ball through the Frankfurt defence rather than, you know, long balls. Because, I mean, God knows how many times that back line tried to play a long ball up to Füllkrug to kind of head it down or something, and you could see he was just kind of rolling his eyes saying, what am I supposed to do with this?
Look, in fairness, that's exactly how the first goal came about. It really, I said, good long ball into Füllkrug. He's controlled it really well, laid it off to Sabitzer. That worked well on that occasion, and it came out of nothing. I don't think it was the Dortmund plan to go to Frankfurt and have to have a slagging match and a roller coaster ride of exchanging six goals. And I got the impression from Terzic speaking after the game, but also from Sebastian Kehl, that they were a little bit shocked to have, and a bit relieved to have got away with the point that they did. And I guess it's not a massive criticism, because it's been a really, really tough week for them, and it's turned out ultimately to be a very, very good week. I mean, it's not easy to think they had to go away to Newcastle. Well, I was going to say maybe the toughest away game in that group, but it's actually their three really, really tough away games in that group, aren't they? But either way, Newcastle having beaten PSG 4-0, 1-0, whatever it was, to go to St James's Park, and I mean, I thought they were incredibly professional, incredibly stable, incredibly clinical in Newcastle, probably Dortmund's best performance of the season. But then to come back from that, to go away to a place like Frankfurt and still come away with a point, ultimately a really, really good week. But they only had themselves to blame for the game turning into the goal fest it did. And like I said, partly down to that lax defending down the left.
I have a final point as well on this. Once again, Youssoufa Moukoko comes on and rescues Edin Terzic's skin.
Yeah, super sub.
With a really, really, really professional goal. Stefan, you and I have talked about Moukoko a lot this year. What does it say about Edin Terzic that this kid, you know, when he's asked up and doing something, he does it, right? At a very high professional level. And yet he doesn't get the opportunities that he probably deserves. And I think that is something really tough that Edin Terzic has to ask himself here, right? Especially the game where Füllkrug didn't score, where Sebastian Haller still struggles. It's ultimately this teenager who comes on and gets the job done. And when does the point come when they just say, well, maybe we remember the super talent that we had, maybe we should give him some more playing time?
It's an interesting one. The relationship between Terzic and Moukoko is an interesting one. I don't think there's any problem there. I wouldn't go along with the hints that the relationship is in any way strained or difficult. I think that the complete opposite is true. I mean, Terzic made that point on several occasions last season about the relationship he has with Youssoufa Moukoko. I don't think there's any issue there. He also made the point on several occasions how valuable Moukoko is off the bench, and not just Moukoko, Jamie Bynum-Gittins as well. He's made that point on several occasions of how he likes having these options off the bench, perhaps to a lesser extent Julien Duranville, although he's not played that much. Moukoko has had his chances in the past couple of years in the starting 11, and you can't really get away from the fact that he has delivered more and been more effective off the bench, as he was against Frankfurt. And I stand corrected myself as well. I must admit to the two of you, on Sunday when he came on, I was actually just about to text the two of you saying, I can understand him taking Reiner off and replacing him with Adeyemi, but why is he taking Daniel Malen off? He's been one of their best players this season. And then in that moment, Moukoko put it in the back of the net. So I thought I'd delete that message.
And he still admitted that you wrote a door.
that's actually quite a good kind of segue to what the point I was going to make, which was, you know, Dortmund's first half was a worst case scenario. You know, not only did they get a bad penalty call, in my opinion, not only does Gregor Kobel have to go off, probably their best player of the season with an injury, and you know, they find themselves 2-0 down before they even know what's going on. I actually was really impressed with the way that Terzic kind of reacted to that at halftime. As you said, he brought Moukoko on, and Moukoko, I'm sure Matt knows what I'm talking about. I'm sure everyone who watched the game knows what I'm talking about. But, you know, Moukoko played so close to Füllkrug in that game. They basically played off one another, and it brought such a better presence to that Dortmund attack, because it really did feel like Füllkrug was quite isolated in the first half. You know, that's obviously how it kind of led to his goal. Adeyemi, I actually thought was more of a defensive substitute, if you can believe it, because I think, you know, as Matt made the point, as Bolton, the Reina was useless in protecting his fullback, but Adeyemi, just by the sheer pace that he has, is able to kind of keep up with those fullbacks and probably kind of pins the Frankfurt right back because he's aware of the fact that he's got to kind of deal with Adeyemi's pace, which ultimately led to Dortmund obviously getting the third goal through the cross that Brandt converted. So, you know, I think Terzic actually, I mean, and on this podcast, I have been one to criticise his in-game management at times. It does feel like, you know, I think I said in the chat that previous Dortmund iterations under Terzic were almost just, it's just vibes and nothing else. You know, it's just like 11 guys go to the pitch, do what you guys can do. In this season, we've seen him be far more kind of regimented and far more intricate with his tactics. And I thought the substitutions he made at halftime made a big difference. But I think the thing that impressed me the most and what made me come away from this game actually wanting to give Dortmund a lot of praise was the sheer kind of mental capacity or fortitude that they had to keep going to win that game. Or not to win the game, but to at least take a point from it, I thought was really impressive. And it's not something that I think we often associate with Dortmund sides, where they keep fighting till the end and they always find a way to get a point. It's something that I've often associated far more with Bayern Munich over the years, where, you know, they can be on the road, they can go down a few goals, they could be 2-0 down after 25 minutes, but you just know Bayern are going to find some way to at least get a point from this game. And that's kind of what we saw from Dortmund in that second half. And I thought that was really interesting because, you know, you can argue about the tactics or the players' performances or, you know, how bad Ben Zabaini is at left back and things like that, but definitely feels like the kind of ethos or moral, or not moral, morale in this team is definitely at a higher level under Terzic this season.
I don't think you're wrong in noticing that, Stefan. I think that's been a change that maybe wasn't predictable in Dortmund this season. But as it is absolutely undeniable now after eight or nine games, Borussia Dortmund, again, this is not to say that they've solved all their problems and they're going to march on and finally win the title or anything, but there is definitely a marked difference in attitude, in, sorry to mention the word again, mentality and general approach. That's clear to see. The fact that they were able to hang on and maintain their discipline and, general togetherness, team spirit, fighting spirit in Newcastle, despite Newcastle hitting the bar twice late on. Similarly, coming from behind twice away at a team like Eintracht Frankfurt, absolutely shows that this is a slightly different team. We're with a different approach, and Terzic repeated the mantra in the press conference on Sunday. He said, as he said the week before, less sexy, more successful. So it's not an accident, and I think we said before that the longer these performances go on, the less it becomes Edin Terzic supports Borussia Dortmund, who don't really have much of a plan, to this looks a little bit like a plan. And I think he deserves credit for that.
I'm going to cut off the Dortmund talk here because we want to talk about two other teams, including the one that's currently first in the table. No, not Bayern Munich. They're not first. Bayer Leverkusen. They beat Freiburg 2-1 on Sunday as well. Guys, this has been a remarkable run for them. I thought that this was actually quite a difficult game for them to play. Ultimately, Florian Wirtz with a really great individual effort to make it 1-0. Hoffmann then made it 2-0 with, well, I guess it was Atapolo really who came down as the scorer, right? Or was marked down as the scorer of an own goal. I wrote about that in the newsletter. Really unfortunate. That's a goalkeeper nightmare when the ball hits the post and it bounces off your back into the goal. Yes, this has happened to me before. There's absolutely nothing you can do. I wrote
curiously,
in the newsletter
Florian Wirtz still got the assist though.
Yeah, and I think the Bundesliga app has Hoffmann down or was a kicker as the goal scorer. I don't know if I agree with that because it wouldn't have gone in without it hitting Atubolo's back, right?
Exactly. Unfortunately for Atubolo, it's an own goal.
Yeah, I think it's definitely an own goal. Like, obviously Hoffmann is the one who strikes it, but I think it's one of those own goals where you really can't blame the own goal scorer. Because, like, what is he supposed to do, right? I mean, he has to dive into that direction and then the ball bounces back. I mean...
The Bundesliga websites gave it to Hoffman.
Oh, there you go. Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a Hoffman goal, but that's just me. I always learned that if the ball doesn't cross the line, like if the ball wouldn't have crossed the line without the own goal scorer scoring the goal, it doesn't count as a goal scored, right?
Yeah, Transfermarkt have also gave the goal. I think what they've done there is that they maybe view a situation like that the same way that you'd maybe view like a deflected shot going in.
Yeah.
So if say someone hits a shot off target but a deflection puts it in the net, still counts as a goal from the player who hit the shot. So maybe it's like that.
Okay.
But yeah, you're that's right. Obviously, debate. I'm just talking about technicalities here. It doesn't change the point you're making.
Either way. I think, then Freiburg obviously brought one back, right? But I thought it was actually quite a professional performance and it wasn't one of their best games, but yet they still get the job done. And so, Stefan, we've been asking this ourselves a few times, but when are we considering Leverkusen a serious title challenger here?
Oof.
Is this like asking Tottenham fans whether they're going to win the title this year? It's pretty much equivalent, isn't it?
Well, both teams look like they could do exactly that, to be honest with you. Maybe the stars are aligning or something.
Oh my God, the world will definitely end if both of them win the title.
I mean, I think Leverkusen definitely had the ride of luck a little bit here. You know, there was obviously the whole kind of fiasco towards the end of the game. Freiburg certainly had their chances, but I think the key thing here, and I know it sounds like an easy answer, but Florian Wirtz really, really is the kind of magic man here. You know, I watched Leverkusen last weekend against Wolfsburg, and it was a game in which, similarly, they came up against a very strong opponent. Frimpong scores first for Leverkusen. Wolfsburg equalised before halftime, and it's at that point where you're really thinking, this is maybe the kind of games where Leverkusen drop points, they start to fall away, Bayern overtake them, and everything's back to normal. But Florian Wirtz comes on in the 60th minute, and all of a sudden things change. And Wirtz started in this game, and I think, as good as Leverkusen have been recently, I think if Florian Wirtz isn't in that team, I don't think they win this game, to be perfectly honest with you. You can see that very directly from the fact that he scored an outstanding goal, obviously, set up the second one and smacked the ball off the crossbar as well. So, in his form has been nothing short of incredible. I kind of tallied up how he's performing in the league so far this season and I stuck it in threads actually this afternoon. So just give some context to how well he's doing in case anyone's been living in a cave for the last 6 or 7 weeks. But according to Opta, when you compare him to all other midfielders in the league, he's first for successful dribbles, first for shots on target, first for through balls, third for key passes, which is a pass that leads to a shot, and also has 2 goals and 4 assists in 9 games. And Leverkusen are obviously by no means a one-man team, but in games like this one and last week where, Leverkusen are coming up against two teams with, considerable hopes of probably finishing the top six this season, he has proved to be the difference maker. And in terms of whether they can win the title, they've already played Leipzig, they've already played Bayern, they gave as good as they get. Obviously, they've still got to play Dortmund, I suppose, in that regard. But yeah, so far, so good, I would say. And they've proven time and time again against some really good teams in the Bundesliga that they can match just about anyone on the day.
Yeah, I watched the Europa League fixture midweek as well. And similar to Frankfurt, right? Karabakh is a team that you have to beat, but you have to beat the opposition in front of you. And they did this with a 5-1 win. And we've seen this so many times in the last few years, right? Where Bundesliga teams make a meal out of playing these smaller oppositions. And I was thoroughly impressed with that performance as well. And, they have so many dangerous pieces, like whether it's Boniface, whether it's Frimpong, Wirtz, obviously. That goal that he scored to make it 1-0 against Freiburg was just otherworldly. Such an incredible individual effort. And then the finish as well. If you haven't seen it yet, you need to go and see it. I think it just kind of feels like this team is a bit on a rampage. And I guess it really just matters on how much longer they can keep it going, right, Matt?
I disagree a little bit when you said that it was maybe one of Leverkusen's sort of not one of their best games. I actually thought it exhibited a lot of the things that are making Leverkusen so good this year. I think just one extra thing on Wirtz. Obviously, you've mentioned how good the goal was. And he absolutely ran the show, particularly in the first half. He was outstanding. The reaction from Christian Streich and Xavi Alonso to his goal, I thought was really interesting. Christian Streich basically turns to his own bench and his coaching staff and just laughs. And then you don't see them both in the same shot, but it seems quite clear to me that Streich then sort of glances across at Alonso, because Alonso's glancing in the same way and basically sort of smiles and shrugs his shoulders as if also, yeah, what can you do about that? He's twisted four defenders inside out.
It's messy. It's like a messy goal.
It really is incredible.
I thought the finish got me, because that angle is almost impossible, and it just hits that back of the net with a dunk, right?
Also, I'm not going to try and compare the situations too much, but if I attempt that complexity of dribble and twisting and turning. Now, leave aside the fact that I can't actually pull it off anyway, but it's the strain it puts on your legs to dink and dive back and forth, turn one way, one direction, then in the other, turn back whilst retaining control of the ball and evading tackles from three or four professional Bundesliga defenders. And then retaining the strength, composure, fitness, and quality to finish the way he did. Yeah, I can't praise the goal highly enough. It really is incredible. Quick mention of Victor Boniface. Obviously, he wasn't directly involved in any of the goals or assists against Freiburg, but I still thought his performance was really, really interesting, that we really saw a side to him, which I think maybe went under the radar a bit in the opening few games when he was taking the headlines with the goals. I thought he exhibited loads of pace down the wing, and he was drifting out wide a lot more than he had done in previous games, and offering a threat from wide positions. Thought that was really interesting. I thought some of his control, his touches in the box, I can think of one instance where he brings down a high ball first on his head, chest, brings it down with an outstretched foot before laying it off neatly to, I think, Palacios, who shoots over, or the goalkeeper saves. But some really, really neat touches from Boniface. Also, not to forget, he's clearly been watching Harry Kane the day before, because he also has an effort from the halfway line, very, very similar to Kane, apart from he's put it just a few yards further wide. So I thought that was really interesting. If there is, and this is where I'll probably come back to maybe actually agreeing with you slightly, Manu, did we maybe see a glimpse of where Leverkusen do have a weakness in that Freiburg's goal came from, I think, two substitutes in, or certainly Grifo had been brought on, and Gulda, I think, with a header, I think he'd also been brought on. Corner, front post header, should probably be defending that better. So again, not going to claim that we've cracked Xavi Alonso, we've cracked by Leverkusen. They won't win it, but yeah, maybe something to keep an eye on.
But set pieces has been something that they've struggled with all season.
Yeah, exactly.
They've conceded more set pieces now than any other team in the league. Actually, they've conceded six, and only Cologne have a higher XG against from set pieces in the league so far. So.
I was hopeful you had those stats, because I knew that they were the worst, but I didn't have that number in front of me. So, great assist, Stefan.
And Matt's right. Like, we can sit here and spend a whole night talking about how great Florian Wirtz is, but at the end of the day, they still have Heredeki in goals, Jonathan Tah.
Podesky actually made a fantastic save at 2-1, which without that would have been 2-2. Vital save.
But I think he has... No, there's no doubt about it, but I still feel like he's not. Anyway, I don't want to start another Heredeki rant, because that wasn't my initial point. So I don't want to. But my actual point was to kind of focus in on Tapsoba, actually, who I think sometimes he gets linked to the Premier League so much that I think some people just assume he's the finished article. No, I know that, but it also means that people maybe just assume he's a finished product, and I think he's still a very raw player. And, you know, I think that's maybe a good example. That's maybe why we're seeing, like, Leverkusen maybe look quite vulnerable from set pieces. If you kind of look across that back three, you know, Jonathan Tah, well documented that he has his issues. Herdecke's got his issues, but also I think Tabsoba in particular can still be error prone in these kind of high profile matches.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think what really rescues them is that they have a World Cup winner and Granit Xhaka in midfield.
That midfield pair,
cleaning up a lot of those mistakes ahead of time.
Of Wirtz, Xhaka and Hoffmann just ahead of them is very, very strong. That's some extremely good squad building
there and
by Simon Rolfes. Yeah, that was really impressive. Yeah. And you can see how much, the extent to which Jonas Hoffmann is Leverkusen's game, you also see how much Borussia Mönchengladbach are missing him. I've always thought a very underrated player, and I'm glad to see him doing well.
I think Hoffmann is an upgrade to Diaby. I know, controversial thing to say.
Very controversial. I think different types of players. I wouldn't associate Hoffmann with the sort of dribbling and pace that
Diaby brings.
I think
it fits better. Mm. I think he's a better team player all around than Diaby was.
Maybe a slightly better finisher as well, slightly more clinical finisher. Yeah. But then again, I'm not going to take too much away from Diaby, one of my favourite players to watch in the Bundesliga. I mean, I would go to Leverkusen, even on days I wasn't working, just to watch Moussa Diaby alone. Fantastic player.
No, it just meant as like a piece fitting into this team. It just feels like an upgrade because, you know, he's he rounds the team up better in many ways than maybe Diaby did.
I think Hoffman's probably a better all-round player. Diaby is obviously a very, very good direct player, and he still does have exquisite skills, but I completely agree with you. I mean, the fact that Hoffman can kind of just play in the middle of the park, or he can play out wide, and he's also so good at kind of playing off. I mean, Wirtz and Diaby had a great connection with each other, but I mean, Hoffman, no other winger created more goals or assists last season than Jonas Hoffmann in a very average Gladbach team, so he certainly deserves his spot at a team that's now pushing for titles, and I hope he gets them.
Yeah, me too. One team that will stand in the way of it, have an English striker who scored from the halfway line. We have to talk about this. The game itself, actually, you know, the game itself was kind of chaotic.
The game itself was absolutely ridiculous. Three red cards in one half and eight goals in the other. It was obscene.
Yeah, but then the moment Darmstadt went down to 9 men against 10 Bayern players, the scoreline was always going to go that way. How ridiculous. It's one of those eight. Usually when Bayern win a game 8-0, I'm like, yeah, whatever, boring. But the first half alone meant that there was so much to talk about that. And then Harry Kane scores this halfway goal. I'm going to actually write about halfway line goals in the newsletter this week. So stay with me here. But
the Beckham documentary hype. That's all you're trying to do.
No. But what Beckham did was great. But there was a certain Bernd Schuster and a certain Klaus Augenthaler did it way before that. Stay tuned to my newsletter. You'll see. I there was one moment though where and the cameras, and I put it on Threads. I know, Matt, you currently can't see Threads because Threads isn't available in Europe yet, but it was really well captured where he takes the shot and you can just tell that it's going to go in, right? It's one of those iconic moments. And you just know this Kane goal is going to be played on Sport 1 for decades.
Yeah. Or in the little kind of halftime montages that they play in the Bundesliga feed. I actually missed this game because, as you said, Manu, I saw Bayern versus Darmstadt, boring. I've got better things to do with my Saturday.
That'll teach you for talking down Bayern Darmstadt.
Well, I actually got to watch Stuttgart Hoffenheim, which I thought was an exquisite game as well.
Yeah, really, really good game.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true.
That was a great game.
So I'm okay with that. But yeah, it's also... It's a really hard thing to do to score from the halfway line. I mean, it seems silly to say, but there's a TV show in the UK, which I'm sure Matt will remember, called Soccer AM, where they used to have footballers on every weekend to try and hit the crossbar from the halfway line. And they'd line up the whole squad and they'd take turns, obviously, in their training ground. And I reckon about maybe 10% of them could even get the ball anywhere near the goal. Never mind hit a crossbar, but even get it towards the goal itself from the halfway line. So for Harry Kane to do that with a goalkeeper running back on goal in the middle of a match, yeah, incredible.
Well, and we literally saw 24 hours later that when Victor Boniface tried it and it drifted wide. So there you go. It's really not as easy as it seems.
And we see it pretty much all the time, right?
To read into that Harry Kane goal, though, I mean, there's not that much you can say about Harry Kane. Everyone knows what he does and what he delivers. But I just want to highlight the pure accuracy of it. And he doesn't just do it with that one shot. Again, maybe this is obvious to people who've watched even more of Harry Kane than me. I don't know, but I was keeping a close eye on him in Mainz last week where, you know, the press box is very low down. I thought it's great to really keep an eye on players. And the way Harry Kane drops deep, almost as deep as the halfway line at times, in that sort of pivot role to pick up the ball deep. And then so many occasions he would launch a cross-field ball, but always with pinpoint accuracy. It really is something to behold. And it was precisely that same skill, that same accuracy, which came into play for his finish against Darmstadt. So that was just a little takeaway that I took from it.
You know, you can see his impact on the game by the very fact that, yes, he's second in goal scoring behind Aset and Serhou Guirassy. You may have caught that story. We mentioned it on the show here and there. He's second behind Guirassy with 12 goals. But right behind him is a certain Leroy Sané with 8. And, you know, like, I don't think Leroy Sané would be on 8 goals at this point of the season if Bayern hadn't bought Harry Kane. And I think that tells you everything you need to know about the impact that Harry Kane had on Bayern Munich.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think Matt hits the nail on the head, actually, when he talks about the accuracy that Kane has. And I think that's something that, I think if you had to pick one attribute that he has that has allowed him to become an elite footballer, it is his accuracy with the ball at his feet. You know, he's not the fastest player, he's not the strongest player, he's not the biggest guy. He's not a huge athlete.
He's actually quite big though, Stefan. I'm surprised. Like, you're right, he's not fast. And that's actually another thing that really surprised me watching him in the Bundesliga, because most Bundesliga strikers are very fast, right? He isn't. He his frame is quite big.
He compensates that lack of pace so well with the intelligence of the way he drops deep.
He drops deep into spaces that nobody else sees.
And it really is top, top, top class.
Yeah.
The only point I was going to make was that accuracy with finishing is obviously something he's been able to apply to his passing in the kind of latter stages of his career. Because if you watch his development at Spurs, he comes through as this excellent kind of penalty box striker. But as he develops, he becomes this kind of all-round forward who can create passes or create goals as often as he scores them. He obviously had that great link-up with Heung-Min Son, and he was able to do that very well with Leroy Sané too. And that obviously adds a whole new kind of facet to this Bayern attack, where, as in the past, they relied on Robert Lewandowski to be the finisher, and he was obviously very good at doing that, you know, arguably the best in the world at it. Harry Kane comes in and he can play the Robert Lewandowski role arguably as well as Lewandowski, but he can also provide the build-up play, which maybe Lewandowski didn't have, and perhaps something that Bayern will need more of in the really tight crunch games, you know, perhaps against Dortmund at the weekend, but also I'm thinking more so the Champions League matches, where in the past, you know, Lewandowski has finished the chances that he's had, but, you know, against really good teams that can push Bayern back, there's been instances where, you know, Lewandowski's been maybe isolated because he doesn't have the same link-up play. And if Harry Kane can bring that to his, if he can bring that side of his game to Bayern as he has done so far, then it's that kind of little extra string to Bayern's bow that can maybe help them, you know, properly challenge in the Champions League.
I think that'll be really key next week, the extent to which he can bring his creativity to bear to compensate for the absence of Joshua Kimmich. Just to move it forward next week, no Kimmich, he'll be suspended. So it'll be all the more impetus on the likes of Kane. and the other creative players in midfield. Also, I thought Konrad Leimer was really impressive as well against Darmstadt. Admittedly, you can't read too much into the Darmstadt game because it's just obviously, by its very nature, a unique and bizarre situation. Having a
10 against 9. Yeah,
10
is
against
really
9,
weird.
Exactly. And seriously, you could see like sort of spaces opening up at times, which would never have opened up in a normal game. And I think it took even Bayern maybe a while to get used to that, hence why it was 0-0 at half-time. But obviously, once the floodgates opened, they well and truly did. But really bizarre situation, which you had to feel for Darmstadt by the end.
Being a man down against Bayern is hard, but being a man down, having lost two players and still being a man down, right? It's just that just adds such a different element because they were, you know, it was pretty even even when it was 10 against 10. But yeah, as you said, that room, that extra room, and if Bayern get that extra room, you know, then that attack. We talked about this last week, right, Stefan? No problem. Like we lots of issues with the defense, but that attack is maybe one of the best, maybe the best in Europe. If you put all the individual pieces together, so if you give them that room, dear God,
that's what made it such an impossible task for Darmstadt. Is that it's one thing Bayern players getting room and getting spaces, but that would normally be in positions and spaces which you've identified previously and would have attempted to close down. In a situation where it's 10 against 9 for 60 minutes, those spaces are not spaces you've reckoned with. And I think particularly, I think it was one of Musiala's strikes where I thought, that's a position where normally in 11v11, that's a space that Darmstadt would target defensively to try and rule that out. And obviously, this was just it started to resemble a bit of like a 7-on-7 kick around in the park when one person's gone home early and everyone else is tired.
Yeah, 3 goals by Kane, 2 by Musiala, 2 by Sané, and 1 by Thomas Müller. Remarkable, guys. We're out of time. We probably spend another 15 minutes talking about this, but unfortunately, time is up. We'll be back soon with more content. Obviously, this show is brought to you by BetOnline. Matt, before you go, where can people find you? I know Threads isn't that thing yet. Both Stefan and I are moving mostly over to Threads, right, Stefan? But until Threads becomes available for you, I guess you're still mostly on Twitter and a little bit on Blue Sky. I see you there as well.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter and Blue Sky still. I'll be in Kaiserslautern tomorrow night for the cup game against Cologne.
Jealous.
I've decided to spend my Halloween in a city where it's Halloween every day. So that's what I'm doing on Tuesday
on the Betzenberg, where the devil lives.
If you want to see any impressions from Kaiserslautern against Cologne in the dark on a Tuesday night,
jealous.
Then that's where to meet. One last thing on a slightly more serious note, just before we started recording, and carrying on from a thing we mentioned last week, Mainz have actually lifted Anwar El Ghazi's suspension and issued an official warning instead, with a view to opening the door to him and rehabilitating him and reintroducing him to the team. Obviously, as we mentioned last week, he was suspended for a post regarding the Middle East conflict, which Mainz said contradicted their club values. And as I said, I did a piece from Mainz last week talking to fans, journalists, people at the club to try and understand some of the reasons why that was the case. So, yeah, feel free to look back into that background and back into that context in the light of Mainz's decision today. Mainz's decision has also been communicated in English on their website, so feel free to have a read of that. And I just think it's an interesting element of German football culture and perhaps society in general. Made accessible via football, which I think is always a good thing. So wherever you stand on these things, do feel free to have a look.
Yeah, Bayern also did some Masraoui and Peretz, right?
I just want to make one point, Manu, before we wrap up. On the note about social media and Twitter kind of falling apart, I'd just like to kind of once again promote the Matchday threads that we do post on, not threads, the Matchday chats, I think they're called, on Substack, that we post every weekend. It's where we kind of talk with the paid subscribers and we have kind of real-time conversations during the games. This weekend's keep calling them threads. I think they are actually called threads on Substack, so that's why I'm getting confused. But it's basically like a forum we set up, and we have a post for the match days, and this match days post had 273 comments, and it's a lot of fun. And I'm sure the people listening to this, the paid subscribers, will know who I'm talking about, but it was a good laugh. And I have found myself more and more every weekend, not just because it's our Substack and, you know, we benefit from it, but because I'm not on Twitter anymore, and because Threads are a little quiet, and obviously most of the German football isn't over there yet. It's a really good place if people are looking for an alternative to social media and they just want to follow, you know, a live stream of people's comments about games. Because, you know, I was watching Stuttgart, we had some guys watching other games, they were commenting, there's a few Gladbach fans in there who comment every weekend, for example. So it's a really good place if you feel like Twitter's kind of drying up a bit and you're looking for a community of Bundesliga fans. I would definitely recommend, you can take a free trial on our Substack, and then you can have a read of it on the Substack app over the weekend. And yeah, if you like it, obviously you can stick around, say hi, welcome, introduce yourself, and everyone's really nice in there. I think it's becoming a kind of necessity for me every match day.
Yeah, and we answer questions on there too. Need to point that out as well. Like if we can answer it, or like if our reporting analysis, we definitely answer questions on there as well. Yes, we're both active on there quite a bit. I enjoy it as well. I think it's great. It's a good community just to bounce ideas around too. And yeah, everyone has been incredibly passionate about the Bundesliga, while not taking it into a direction that we too often see on Twitter nowadays. I do enjoy Threads as well, but Threads is more like a place where you post an idea or a thought, and then it just kind of sits there, right? It's kind of like a written Instagram, I guess, which makes sense because that's kind of, you know, that's where it stems from. But I do have to say I have enjoyed Threads as well. So yeah, you can find me there as Manu Wef. Stefan Biankowski is your handle on Threads, right?
Yes, Stefan_Biankowski.
Yeah, Stefan_Biankowski. Yeah, I'm just Manu Wef. Anyways, guys, we need to wrap this up. A marathon podcast today, but I think a lot of fun. Thanks for listening to the show. We'll be back soon. Until then, auf Wiedersehen.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.